All right, you are now.
Okay, let's call to order the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, March 24, 2016. First item is to approve our agenda for the evening. Do I have a motion to approve our evening's agenda?
So moved.
Okay, second?
Yes, second.
So, motion by Mr. Von Trapp, second by Ms. Miller. Are there any changes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the agenda say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. And just as a note, I did that in the past, but I'm going to do it in the future. That way, if any of you have something you want to put on the agenda, it's an opportunity for it to get on, since we don't normally get consulted in advance. So, next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Is there anybody from the public that wishes to comment on something not on tonight's agenda?
Right now, we're just observing.
Okay. Seeing no one from the public, then we'll move on to item number 4, which is the public hearing amendments to North Bend Municipal Code, Chapter 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to installation of franchise utility facilities and streetlights.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
We don't have approvals on this going on yet.
Thank you. I signed the minutes from last month, and it just was like out of my head. So let's back up to item number 2, and I thank Commissioner Ryan. Approval of minutes from March 10th, 2016. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I've been thoroughly, and I think that's appropriate.
Well, I was going to make one suggestion.
Could I get a motion, please?
I have moved to approve minutes from last meeting.
And a second?
Second.
So, motion by Mr. Von Trapp, second by Ms. Miller. Comments or changes?
I was not present for the meeting. It was marked that I was.
Thank you for making that update. My...
Yes, so we will bring this back for signature.
Any other comments or changes? All right, all those in favor of approving the amended minutes for March 10th, 2016, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries, is unanimous. So back to item number 4, which is a public hearing amendments to North Bend Municipal Code, Chapters 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to installation of franchise utility facilities and streetlights. Mike, do you need to say anything before we open the public hearing?
Oh, I'll give just a very brief introduction. I recognize you, but I can't remember your name.
Jim Caterlinger.
Yeah, Jim. Thank you very much for coming. So this is just to consolidate three different chapters that we have in our municipal code that govern different types of franchise utilities. So we've got cable television, we've got telephone, electrical and street lighting, and we have different provisions in those different sections of code that in some areas are in conflict with one another or at least confusing. So we're trying to bring those together, trying to get rid of outdated information, and also provide more specificity where we need to, such as when undergrounding is required and areas that street lighting needs to be provided, where it doesn't, and light levels. We've provided some amendments from the time that the Planning Commission has since your last meeting, based on comments from Puget Sound Energy and from staff and from your recommendations. So we've hopefully got those all in there. Those amendments are provided in redline format so that you can see those. Planning Commission also received on your desk in front of you two comment letters. The first one from CenturyLink we received today. And we will have our city attorney take a look at that because they're referencing some state law that they think our regulations are inconsistent with. So we'll take a look at that and bring back amendments based on the recommendation of our attorney for your consideration for next meeting. The other one is an email that we received just after we sent the packets out to you on Friday from Puget Sound Energy. And actually it was just before, but we didn't have time to go back and change the staff report, but we did actually provide in your draft that you have before you in the blue text the edits that PSC had suggested. They have a few other suggestions that you'll see in the comment box that we want to take some time to look at, so we'll bring those back to you for your next meeting. We didn't have time again to provide that in the packet.
Okay. Thank you for that update, Mike. So at this time, at 7:10, I'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on amendments to North Bend Municipal Code. Is there anybody from the public that wishes to testify?
I don't believe we have any problem with it. The only thing that Tanner's concerned with is transmission line, with the future build out to the middle port area.
Could you please just state your name and address for the record?
It's Jim Anderson, Tanner Electric Cooperative. Our physical address is 45710 Southeast North Bend Way, North Bend. We do have a concern on future expansion with the future substation going into town to serve the east side of town on the Middle Fork property with the transmission line that will need to be constructed to feed that substation. The cost of an underground installation is astronomically high for transmission, where we will need to, we're concerned is if anything comes along as far as the way that he does for putting the overhead transmission to that substation, to that property we currently have. We think it would put an undue hardship on our members and on the utility to have to construct an underground line versus the overhead transmission. And that's the only thing that we really are concerned about at this point. Tanner stands. We currently, any upgrades, developments going in, would require all of our contractors to go underground. So we're fine with all the amendments, just with concerns on transmission buildings.
Thank you very much.
Would that exception cause any parts of the circuit beyond that, any other problems?
As far as?
If you're required to go underground with that, what other problems would that cause throughout the circuit?
If we go underground, the cost shoots up to us to almost, can be upwards, almost $4 million a mile. So, and it would create some vaults that would be probably 20 by 30 for underground vaults that have to be stationed down the area, which is a huge vault. It just creates a lot of problems for us as far as transmission. It's very uncommon for the utility to build a transmission line underground.
Are these underground vaults waterproofed?
No, they are not waterproofed. Our equipment all is waterproof, can be submerged.
And just for clarification for you, the regulations that we have do differentiate between transmission and distribution lines, and the undergrounding requirements only apply to distribution lines.
That would be perfect for us. But and the other concern I guess we would have is any reconstruction or rebuild of existing facilities that we do have. We would be concerned about the requirement to be made that if we change out four or five poles somewhere along the lines that are the rest of the system on, we'd have to go underground. Placement or repair of the structure. That would be one thing that we would see on the distribution side that could pose a problem.
Can you clarify that again?
For instance, we'll just use the trail that's running through town. We currently have a distribution line overhead on the trail that runs all the way back down the trail on 8th Street. As we move forward in our plans to keep our system as robust as possible and serve the growth that's coming along, we're going to have pole replacements or reconductoring that goes in. To increase the wire size to allow us to serve the needs of the community as it grows. If we have to change out four or five or six of those poles in a row, we would be concerned that we would be excluded from the requirement to go underground at that point.
How many miles are you considering?
Currently, and we're working with Longville Power Association on this, there is also that is the power provider. There's two proposals on deck with one of them, PSE and Tanner. There is the construction of the line from the Tanner substation out on 8th Street through town to the PSE substation. But the reliability of that substation their transmission has faltered over the years, and that's about 1.8 miles. So they are looking at reconstruction, doing a rebuild on their substation in there. So from that point to Tanner's Middle Fork sub is almost 1.8 miles as well. So we're talking about 3.6 miles total.
Thank you for that.
And one other additional clarification to your concern about maintaining or replacing poles, these provisions about undergrounding apply to development or redevelopment, which is defined. And so that wouldn't include just your facilities. That's when something else happens, some sort of new building, et cetera, happens that meets those definitions. That's what triggers then the underground.
So if it just to so the work around Tanner, if there was a division subdivision that moves in or a new facility that goes in, then we need to increase our line size for capacity. If an existing overhead system, would we still be allowed to keep the system overhead, increasing our conductor size at that point to serve that load?
That would be maintenance of your system. So this applies to the frontage or the right-of-way that directly abuts the development site.
Even if it was a distribution line versus a transmission?
Distribution line, and then the regulations also provide that it can go beyond the immediate frontage when necessary to get to a pole, but otherwise it's just the immediate frontage.
Thank you.
You have no more next questions, do you?
Oh, no, not at all.
When you have overhead lines, you must maintain the right of way for those over time. Seems to me you also have those overheads are exposed to a lot of outages because of whatever the weather might be. What's your return to service time quotient on a normal outage?
Tanner currently is about 1 to 1.5 hours on restoration on any of our distribution lines. System reliability right now is around 97% for Tanner. So we're fairly strong on our maintenance. We do have an aggressive right-of-way program that we work through the areas we did North Bend last year. It's on a 3-year cycle. We'll come back and redo it again 2 years from now. So we have a fairly good arborist that comes through to maintain adequate clearance without doing too much damage to the existing structures that are out there.
Over the long term, though, when underground service provides you with longer usage of that system while having to replace components?
It would provide us a longer service. Where we run into a lot of problems are the easements that are required to put the underground in, and also the cost of the underground and the utilities. An overhead line for us, if we were to construct new, goes in for about a quarter of the cost of an underground system. So it's something that we have to look at very hard. Tanner being such a small utility, without any big growth coming on, we don't have any major growth starting. We rely on our members and on our rates to provide the capital funding for the projects. And right now we're.
And how would you speak about the safety factors long term? Is the underground service a lot safer for your workers?
Yes and no. It's kind of a double. Underground cabinets and enclosures can create a more hazardous condition than you are confined in, where you are having to open up the cabinet. Anything that happens inside the cabinet can come straight up in front of the cabinet, right into our employees as they work on the systems, which we take all the precautions. We have safe work procedures that go in place, clothing, face shields. We're really proactive as far as safety, and we have a set of guidelines to work on. Versus the overhead, you can see and control the situation much more easily because you have a visual on everything that's happening on the system.
All right. Seeing no one else from the public, then I'll go ahead and close the public hearing at 7:20. Next item on the agenda is our Planning Commission deliberation and discussion. And per Mike's notification, it will not put forth a recommendation at this meeting, since we'll need to hear from the attorney on the comments received. So at this point, I'll start with the Planning Commission. Are there any comments or changes?
On this?
Mr. Ryan.
Yes. That's the issue.
Yep.
Still have a question about the street lights. Yeah, we're talking about the LED lights. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of LED lights. I'm concerned about the white light versus the yellow light.
The color temperature.
Yeah. Just the ambiance in a community with white light just seems to be unnecessarily harsh. But if it's light in the wood, the reason would be to have a white light.
And I guess I'll ask, Mike, in your knowledge, is there anything different in the color temperature of the light per lumens reached at the measurement level? So if you have to have so many candle foot at ground level.
Not that I know of. That's beyond my level of expertise. I did take a look at some of the dark sky information, and the Dark Sky Society, International Dark Sky Society, does recommend having warmer tones to the light because it creates less overall glare up into the sky. Warmer tones being more of your yellow, amber color.
So do we have a range or something that we should specify to achieve that?
We need to look further into that.
I'm just looking at 1906 one here. Paragraph D just begins to talk about brightness and things of that sort, bulbs, and is being very descriptive. It just talks about elements, but I want to know what kind of light are we really talking about. And as we're talking about brighter light in the urban core, so there's a lot of traffic, nighttime traffic.
Yes, so that's again where we have an arterial standard that's at 0.6 foot candles as opposed to the collector in the local street standard at 0.4.
I don't know what those mean.
0.4 is the typical residential standard, or at least what we've seen through review of other regulations and what our consultant was working on in developing the public works standards. So I think that's probably typical to a single family residential subdivision, what you'd see. 0.6 is more like the higher Cobra Head street lights that you'd see along an arterial street.
Mike, how far from the ground is that measured? Because we don't say that here. And I know generally on lighting standards and sidewalk lighting or something like that, there's a measurement height that you take the reading at.
I don't know. That's in the examples that we looked at, it hasn't specified that level of detail on the regulation.
I think it's the lighting level on the ground, because when we do photometrics for, like, Bartels, for example, we have a requirement that you can't have, at the property line, you're supposed to have 0.00, which is really difficult to do in the urban area. And that's based on the light level at the ground as it leaves the site.
Okay.
So,
So this would be at its darkest point, it would be at the ground at 0.6.
Yeah, from the distance.
Everything else should be then theoretically brighter.
Yeah. Now, that's my understanding. I'm not a lighting expert either, as Mike noted. But it is when you do photometrics and you ask for these foot candles, it's all photometrics are the same. They come in with the light level shown on the ground as it spills from the luminaire.
Okay. Yeah. And that'd be consistent with standards that look like
in
nightclubs, they measure it at the ground too.
Yeah, so I think that is something that's standard across the board, and that's why you never see it called out in any codes, because it's just how you administer that light level.
Mr. Ryan, I want to go back to your color temperature. Is that something you'd like to see put in here?
Well, the layman like me wouldn't know what that is. I think it has to be warm.
That dictates the warmer colors. Yeah. That's what you would use to describe it. The technical.
I just want to make sure it gets maybe that kind of discussion's clarified in the document. That talking about a variety of light sources for a variety of densities and so on. You know, I live in a very dark street. Tanner is between homes. It's just really pitch black, and when the moon is out, it's really almost scary to think about taking a walk. Well, which should be a very safe street, but you don't know what's out there. And we have a lot of wildlife walking the area, which is great. I was put to at ease by the metaphoric herd. People were talking about, you know, where are you going to find elk? Cats. Yeah, oh, they're always tracking them. This is fine, you know, but I'd like to have an even break, you know, with some brighter light on the street. And I think other people would too. I don't think that the dark sky people expect the night sky to be dark right at their house. I think they're looking for a dark sky, maybe out some further away. But I think it's a safety issue. I don't know if the police asked about.
Yeah,
they have an opinion about that. I didn't notice it in any comments. But if they have an opinion about it that's different, that'd be good to know either way. And we are trying to remain a rural community, but it seems like we have high-density streets that's already been given away. We probably ought to provide safe habitat for that.
I did have a good phone conversation with Jeremy Michael from Puget Sound Energy in their IntelliLight division, that's their lighting division. And He was supportive of the language that we had about providing it at intersections and street ends and so forth. He gave an example of the city of Kirkland, who's backtracking now. They went with the, I can't remember the name of the organization, it's the American Lighting Society, something like that, which has specific recommendations for minimum lighting levels and average lighting levels throughout a development. And he says that residents in Kirkland have felt that that's way too bright. And so now they're kind of backtracking and saying, well, maybe we want to change our standard to be more distant in certain areas.
I also gave Nick Holmquist a call. And he...
Where is Nick from?
He's our... he's captain. Thank you. Yeah, he's captain. And I think it's Holmquist. Yeah, I put an H there. But that was terrible. So anyway, he said that the lighting levels that we have in our new neighborhoods, they haven't had any issues with, and he even said, wow, you know, we've actually felt like it's a non-issue. We're really happy with the light level. The night sky is more about, it's not about keeping it dark. It's about lighting the pedestrian level, but keeping the sky from glowing so you see the stars and things like that. So it's really that kind of terminology is really about directing the light appropriately so you still get your rural dark sky and that nice vibe while you get the safety on the ground. And he felt like the codes that we've been implementing have done, they feel very happy. He had no comment, he said. Okay. Great job. Keep it up.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Ryan. So, Mike, you've got a note on defining color temperature that's warmer.
Yeah.
But we'll along with proper street lighting, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's not yellow.
I want to also add that in the draft, we provided the comments that Jeremy Michael emailed, and he emailed just a very minor edit there about providing LED fixtures rather than bulbs, and that produced sufficient lumen output while reducing energy consumption. I didn't get that into the draft, so I will do that in your update.
Thanks, Mike. Anything else, Mr. Ryan?
Well, thank you.
Go ahead. Mr. Belchow?
I had a question, just since we're on kind of a similar subject. A couple commission meetings ago, I remember this just the discussion of the spacing of streetlights and noting how the recent, within the last few years on North Bend Way, and then also noticing on Ballarat. And I remember, Jenna, you making a comment saying that regulations have been changed since then to not allow them to be so close together so it doesn't look like a runway. That's my impression.
It was more the full cutoff is implemented. So all of those, okay, so all of those lights that you see as you come into town on in the historic,
right,
okay, and also down Ballarat, those don't have full cutoff fixtures. So that means the bulb inside hangs below, like, the level of the lamp, thanks. So that's, so when you're looking at that kind of light, you actually look at it like you'd look at a headlight of car. Versus on the new Bartels ones, those are all full cutoff. So when you look at Bartels lights at night, you actually don't get the headlight look because the lamp or the luminaire is up in the lamp, and so it's only coming down. So as you look through it, you actually don't see anything but light coming out of it. So we don't allow that anymore. That's a lighting style that. We've even actually looked into potentially retrofitting those to get rid of that, because it is, as you can see, it is glaring. You know, like,
yeah,
glaring.
Right.
Yeah. So that style is no longer. It's just, unfortunately.
And it's very cool white light, too.
Yeah.
So it's even more of a noticeable.
Mm-hmm. You know, when the parking ride lights went in, there has been discussion about trying to, as we deal with the, even if we don't change out to a full cutoff fixture, maybe reducing the wattage, just because they are so bright as you come into town at night. You're out, you know, by tollgate where there's no light, and all of a sudden, boom, you know. So that makes a big difference.
Okay.
And that's now the standard.
Okay.
Okay, so it would be more addressing the design of the fixture rather than the spacing, or so I guess that was my misunderstanding.
Kind of
I didn't
both.
See anything.
Yeah. The spacing right now would be the same. We do have the one street where we do kind of talk about spacing a little bit more is as you come from exit 34 into town. Because we have, you actually have in your downtown master plan a gateway. It's called the graduated gateway. And the intensity of the amenities, like your street trees and your lighting, is supposed to increase as you come into town. So it kind of gives you this sense of like drawing you to the river and over. So that's the one place where there might be a little more intensity, but not much because, I mean, there's really, you know, not much more. I think, what is our spacing? Do you remember?
I don't know that we have a standard.
Yeah, we do in the design standards. Okay. Anyway.
I was concerned because hopefully if we needed to address it here so that we don't have more of that, I wanted that to be included.
Yeah, and we do have the language requiring the full cutoff fixtures.
Okay, I was looking for the wrong thing.
But on that note, you could also consider, should we have something more in downtown lighting requirements? Does it promote more walkability and more nightlife or viability in the downtown core? Is that also an option, Mike? I think we could talk about that in certain areas.
Or? We've got the higher standard for foot candles on your arterial streets, and then we've got the design standards that specify more of the type of fixture and the spacing.
Yeah, I think you're now dialing past just the light levels and into now, like, what actual feature. Fixture do we want?
No, I'm thinking, you know, we have an arterial standard. Should we apply that maybe to a downtown section of, you know, just as a better tourism invitation or something?
Well, these are minimum standards. So whenever we're designing a street project, we'll have a lighting engineer that provides the lighting plan for
based
us, and they'll make a recommendation based on the context of the site and conditions.
Yeah, I get a feeling that this day and age, people like, for some reason, the downtown light's a little bit dimmer. It's kind of cool. I don't know what that does, but they're drawn to it. If it's too bright, they kind of just scatter.
Right.
You know, I can't find the little turn-off chain on these lights.
With a dimmer.
We should install those.
Okay. The only other question I have is more grammatical. On 19.06.060, at the bottom of, what's it, it's paragraph one. And I understand this is a draft, but I was kind of unsure of where to connect. So the bottom of that paragraph, on the right-hand side, you have the word when. And then the red line is either the following circumstances apply. I wasn't exactly sure where when was connected.
Yeah, sorry, it's just with the edits, it's a little harder to see. It's except when the right-of-way, and I'm going to change that capital T to a lowercase.
Okay.
Except when the right-of-way frontage of a new development is less than 4.
That's what I figured. I wanted to make sure. Like I said, I know this is a rough draft.
Did these, in the preamble to this, page 3, these dates make a difference. You've got comment archetypes that still have to come. It hasn't hit yet. You're talking as of March 25th when this report was provided to the Planning Commission.
On page 3
of the document.
Okay. I'll correct that. Actually, I'm going to correct that anyway because the final one that you get for making your recommendation will reference public comment received tonight.
Anything further? Ms. Miller, anything to add?
Well, one of my questions was already answered. So one of my concerns that I'll just reiterate is the amount of heat coming from those lights. So we're talking amber or white light. So that was my specific question, which was we're looking into that. Also, when light hits glassy or wet pavement, there's reflection off of that at night, too.
consensus on where we're told.
One of the other edits that I wanted to bring forward was Puget Sound Energy. You can see in the little comment box on page 2 of the amendments. They were suggesting that we not require 30 feet setback for utilities that are over 36 inches, but 10 feet. And thinking about that, it probably makes sense because you have a lot of other factors that play into that. You've got the access needs, you've got the easement that they then have to secure, and that then affects also the layout of the site features that can go onto the property.
So, okay. So that's something you agree with.
The 30 feet just came after out of a different code that we were looking at.
So I guess I just have one lingering question. We have a trail plan and maybe a dream one day of having bike lane connectivity. There's easements for power lines. Should we think about what is a protected view and try and route power lines a different way? I don't know. It seems like there's mountain views from all along North Bend Way. So where could we put them or route the lines that make North Bend Way cleaner?
If they were on the south side of the road instead of the north,
are you talking which lines?
Power lines, phone lines, telephone poles in general. Take them down or move them somewhere else. Why not think about that? Is, you know, that's a constant from a photographer's point of view, an artist's point of view, people that are standing outside the North Bend Barn Grill taking pictures.
All the transmission lines will be put under ground. Distribution will be put underground as development happens. The transmission would be the only ones, in theory, that you would allow above ground over time. Therefore, is that the line that you're speaking to, or?
Yeah, I'm thinking, why can't we have a plan to put them in one place that's less of an obstruction than they are now? And
so the existing ones.
I think the primary challenge that the utility providers would have would be that they have existing easements or rights of way that's pretty much their area, that it would be very costly and difficult for them to secure easements in other locations.
There's nothing we can do as a city that makes that easier, or is there?
Well, I want to make sure, because all the lines that you're talking about, like Bartels, they were required to put the new underground, and then it pops up at the edge of Bartels, and then if there's redevelopment to the east, then the lines would go. Those would all, so over time, all of those go underground, right? So the view, finding ways to protect the view shed, it almost doesn't, it's irrelevant because they're all, in theory, supposed to go underground.
But I'm thinking if North Bend Way goes to four lanes is when that's going to happen. And I don't know when that might occur. And I'm trying to accelerate that, I guess, is what my thought is.
So you're talking more about...
Because when we do that major road construction, if the businesses never change along North Bend Way for the next 10 years, and traffic, because of all the home development, does require that road to be widened, then at that point, we might put them underground.
Yeah, and that's what the regulations call for with major street projects. Unless specifically exempted by council, they will go underground.
But if they're transmission lines, they're still going to be remaining there. So could we create a plan during that update that routes transmission lines to a certain place that is not as obtrusive?
So you are talking about transmission. Yeah.
Oh, we have an expert here tonight. Maybe, Jimmy, you could offer some thought on that.
That's going to be really hard to do. Procuring and getting the easements and the right of way that will be involved. That could be very interesting to know, because the transmission line has to have a wider easement. You're talking a 30-foot tree trimming clearance from center line both directions, so you could be taking 15-foot of vegetation from the center line of the pole. If you were to run it down on the south side, I could see some issues with that, where the getting outside of the center line or the fog line, you know, we're required to go 10 foot out on any new instruction for transmission for accident. You know, get it out for people so they don't hit our poles. So we put it out 10 feet, and then we're going to get that neighbor that's got a beautiful conifer out there, and we're going to have to take it out because we need to go 15 feet farther. I can see that could pose a very large problem for the utility, plus whoever would have to go talk to the homeowner and explain it.
We're not expecting transmission lines to be ran down the middle of North Bend Lane, correct?
No, if you look at your current system, the transmission lines currently run down the trail. And they go right to the trail to the PSC's North Bend sub here, right on the Forest Service for interdiction. And then from there they take off and they head on the transmission until they get a little farther out of town, and then they cut across or toward Cedar Falls. That's the only transmission that you currently have running through town. It follows that trail all the way through. Everything else you have over there, the distribution lines.
Well, that's very helpful. That's very helpful.
But you definitely wouldn't want to have multiple corridors of those.
Are these easements
in fee,
Jim? Are they
use
only? Yes. Are these easements for exclusive rights, or do you have the fee?
They're exclusive.
So you don't actually own the easement as much as you're using it?
As much as we use it. Currently, we have a franchise agreement with like King County for the majority of our stuff, King County Parks. And I assume PSC is operating already the same franchise agreements that we have as well.
But if you're to go underground, you can provide the easement fee.
We would. Utilities, and I don't like using the word, but there is a clause that utility can claim in the domain. Mm-hmm. When we put stuff in, that's somewhere no utility wants to go. That's something the Tanner will never do. And I believe PNC will operate under the same guidelines. They will not try to enforce that will. But sometimes we do get a resident out there that suddenly values their property extremely high, which can, for an easement, for $300,000-$400,000 for an easement to go across somebody's yard, it's extremely expensive, or it will shoot down a project.
So I guess I'll revert back to staff. Is there anything that you feel we should do in our current guidelines that would help protect the view in any other way? So I'm just putting it out there. I don't know if there is more that needs to be done, but I think we ought to consider it.
I think that's really a good question. We've thought about it many times because I think there is a general anticipation. I think it's just natural that they transmission lines that are on the trail would have to be increased at some point, and that increase would include height. So it's definitely a challenge because it's one of those necessary evils. That undergrounding is very expensive. So do you know if any providers that have been subject to some aesthetic design standards to create higher quality?
There are, and then, previously to my coming to Tanner, I worked for another utility back in Montana, and we built a lot of transmission in there. We lived right in the middle of Yellowstone entrance out through Gardner. When we put this out for our design build, we actually public comment and asked, what would they like to see? And we actually went with a pole transmission that's a metal pole that ages, and it kind of goes to like a rusted metal look. And pretty soon, over a period of time, that's a more desirable pole.
It oxidizes.
It oxidizes, and it'll last for years. It allows you to span a greater area, and that's what we found. If we went with a different type of pole that was aesthetically pleasing or more pleasing, or tried to blend in with surroundings, and then we could increase the span distance between our poles. If the poles were farther apart, people don't tend to see that wire. If you can keep your pole height, depending on which building, your transmission around 65 feet. So it's out of harm's way. The lower canopy can be left intact, where we do an L trim above. So if you're on the trail, you don't tend to see the wires as easily as if you were bare all the way through with the wooden poles that are closer together. And,
very much. Appreciate that. So is that something, you know, we can talk about as, you know, maximum spacing of poles? Anything like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, this would be the place to put that. I think there's trade-offs that you have to consider, because the higher that you put them to space out wider, then you see it for more properties as well. So you just have to consider
what we'll
that.
Do is a little research on options for aesthetics. Maybe you can come in, we can meet, and we can talk about the options that have been implemented elsewhere, and then maybe come back with some provisions. You know, just doing a quick search, there's, you know, you could be as simple as making sure they're all green, and so that, or rust color, or, you know, there are,
yeah.
So we'll sit down and talk about that and see if we can kind of create the least obtrusive approach to this line.
When you have that discussion, would you have a discussion about motion lights in the public sector? Maybe there's a law against it, but it just seems to me that a lot of lights just stay on with no reason for them to be on without somebody needing to use the light. So if I'm walking down the road, it comes on for me. If I leave, it goes off behind me.
That's great.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's brilliant. Yeah. Do you know
not trying to, the motion lights, I totally agree with you. One thing is you guys consider your LED lighting, Tanner just went through and relit everything that we have on our system replaced with LEDs. We also researched and used a firm out of Seattle, with the Seattle-based firm, when we did a relay. One of the safety factors that we have built into the light is a photo eye. Normal photo eye light goes out, and we've got a bunch of them. I know that we've been calling to help the city repair a couple that were out. The new lights have a memory on. Once that light's up and maintains its cycle for a 7-day period, it remembers when it went on and off. Mm-hmm. So if that failure of a light, which causes the lights to stay on most of the time, the new lights actually have a fail-safe in there that will turn the light off. It remembers what it did last night and actually turns itself off and will maintain that cycle. So it gets rid of a lot of wasted energy, and it also gets rid of a lot of light that shouldn't be out there.
And so that would sound like it would be incompatible with kind of the motion sensor, because that would just be irregular. But that's where the technology is heading.
I don't know, Mr. Ryan, if you could clarify, are you thinking for street lights at intersections, or are you thinking for walking trails, or are you thinking for...
Neighborhood lighting.
I'm sorry?
Neighborhood lighting.
Yeah, maybe possible. I know when they had the old sodium vapor and so forth street lights, those would take a really long time from the time the electricity goes through them until they brighten up enough. Mm-hmm. But maybe now with LED, it's possible to on and off more easily.
As long as it works with motorcycles. Of course, the elk will probably set up.
Yeah.
All night long. That's the only downside of somewhere.
Coyotes.
All right. Anything further on our talking about our franchise utilities and street lighting chapter? Okay. So
yeah.
We've got color temperature.
I knew I was commissioned, but I always want to have a discussion about lighting. I think I've had before.
We still have to figure out what the right color temperature is. Okay, so color temperature, you've got the updates to street lighting section D for the PSC. You're going to research the CenturyLink's comments?
Yeah, CenturyLink and the PSC comments. The PSC comments were more minor, but I still wanted the chance to review those more and see if there's amendments that we'd like to provide.
And then an update for undergrounding of existing overhead utilities based on PSC's comment for larger facilities, the landscaping requirements. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions for the Planning Commission before we move on? All right. With that, Mike, we'll move on to item number 6, which is introduction amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.40 bulk and dimensional standards concerning minimum lot size in the constrained low density residential zone.
All righty. Yeah. Well, this is what we're trying to do is.
Thank you.
Bye. We have, I'm just going to kind of preface this by, right now you have kind of a new council that is made up of three new people and the previous existing, and they're working hard to gel and come up with a lot of strategies for, or common vision for what, how they see North Bend and our codes, basically creating that vision on the ground. So, as you know, our codes have been constantly evolving. That's just normal. North Bend has definitely seen a pretty big onslaught of development in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's mainly because we had a unique scenario. You know, North Bend was in a moratorium through the bulk of the, you know, late 90s, 2000, which is when you saw Snoqualmie become the fastest growing city in the state. Meanwhile, little North Bend sat idle. And there's a lot of people that sat for 15 years on property that they bought, and that's a long time to hold on to your property. During that 15 years, people were retiring and they didn't get to do anything with their property that naturally is kind of the stepping stone as you retire. So then North Bend gets our water rights in, we got it in 2009. Was it 9?
No.
It's somewhere in that time frame. And right at the same time, basically, as we're in the middle of a large recession, right? So North Bend kind of, we saw growth during that time frame, but not like we did once that recession basically became kind of somewhat a thing of the past, even though we're still, in a lot of areas, still coming out of it. Washington State is clearly was the quick one of the quicker areas nationwide to come out of that. And in Washington State, I think North Bend was ironically one of the quickest, and it is kind of part of our history of having a lot of people that had been holding onto properties for years and years because of this moratorium, and all of a sudden there was a lot of interest to sell and move on. And
35%
over the year. Yeah, so that's and as Dick said, he's up 35%. I mean, that's a number that a lot of people that, you know, sit back and go, wow. So, fast forward, here we are today. We have a council that right now is doing a really good job having good discussions about what their common vision is. And as a result, I think you're going to be seeing a lot of code amendments coming in the next year that we haven't necessarily anticipated in our work plan. One of which was the CLDR. And so tonight, instead of necessarily going through this, because what we're trying to do from a staffing standpoint is keep up with all the amendments, and because for every topic that you guys have on the table, whether it's researching light levels or, you know, where light is measured, we have that same process happening somewhere else, and then we're basically giving you guys a packet every 2 weeks. So we're either getting it together for you the week before or getting it out. So the reason I'm bringing that up is because to write regulation and write good regulation, you really need to obviously take your time and think it through. And so all of that takes time, as you guys know. I mean, we've spent a lot of time on all the topics. And then, you move from planning commission to council, and you add 7 more minds and 7 more issues or 7 more ideas or 7 more approaches come into the mix, and then you start kind of over again. So anyway, the history with the CLDR, as you guys remember, and this is more for Mary, I think, the Planning Commission actually spent, I think you guys spent almost 3 to 4 years on comp plan when it was all said and done. When I went back to start looking at when you first started talking about your 16 meetings on just land use chapter. So you only have 24 a year, believe it or not, and that's if we go to every single meeting or have every single meeting. So we amended the comp plan. You guys gave a recommendation to the council. They approved it on December 8th of 15. And part of your requirements to have the updated comp plan was to also implement the regulations that support the new zoning that you recommended to council and council adopted. So through your process of doing that, you will recall when it came out of Planning Commission, the CLDR zone was, the CLDR zone was only this area, and it stopped right here, and that actually coincided with your floodplain. So the floodplain is all right here, and it might encumber a little bit of this lot, this area. Anyway, so that's where the Planning Commission recommended CLDR. Went to council, and council felt they wanted a little more larger lots, bigger room on the peripheral of town, so they expanded the CLDR to include all of these areas, okay? Now, one thing about the CLDR, so you know, we do have somewhat some time to have this zone evolve in the next year or two. And the reason I say that is most of this is outside city limits. And the city has made a point to say we're not actively looking to annex. We have enough going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if a citizen group comes and petitions to annex, the council will address it. But I don't think even the council's looking to annex more. I think we've got enough on our plate. So when you look at the CLDR, you're only talking about a few small areas of town. It also includes out here. This area is kind of encumbered on its own right now because there's no sewer out there at the moment. So this area will be slower to develop than any of this because we have sewer available. So then the only area of town we're kind of looking at, or that this zone affects, is this area that has pretty plug-and-play ready infrastructure, okay? So now, as this zone, or these regulations, so when the main issue I think that the council felt after they received your recommendation and adopted it, I think verbatim, if I remember right, it allowed for a lot size. It said it was a 2 dwelling units per acre. So you couldn't do more than 2 dwelling units per acre. But it allowed a minimum lot size of, was it 75?
Same as the
yard.
Which is so it might be easiest to draw on the whiteboard.
So it allowed, so you got an acre right here, which is 43,560. Okay, so, but you can't split this acre into any more than two. So what your recommendation was is, all right, well, if somebody wants to come in and do that, great. If it makes more sense because there's a wetland over here that somebody wants to come in and do that, all right, we're going to allow that. So what you kind of allowed, which the premise of it is great, is you allowed a lot of flexibility in somebody being able to build like something like this that could yield a really maybe big or small, you know, maybe a small house with a little yard that you could have some little more than just a normal backyard. I don't want to say a horse or anything because I don't know if...
Vegetable garden.
Yeah. You could have more of a rural vibe on your property. So what the Planning Commission's recommendation said was, well, this second lot cannot be anything smaller than that, okay? Well, as you were only talking about that small area, there aren't a lot of parcels in there to consolidate and create an opportunity to create a really dense neighborhood in a 2DU per acre zone. So as the council, I think this was one of the misunderstandings or that occurred through the process is that all that rest of the area was added. Let's say now we had a lot more land opportunity to deal with, and all of a sudden this now somebody could consolidate 1 acre into, let's say, 10 acres, right? Well, you could then, based on the code that was allowed, you could then do 9 of those small lots at the 7,500 square foot, repeat that 9 times, and then leave the 10th lot big, and you would still only need 2 DUs per acre. But maybe this is a street. From the street, this is still going to feel like nothing different than. So you kind of lost the variety that you got when you're only dealing with 1 or 2 small lots, or 1 or 2 acres at a time. When you compound that, it created a little bit of a problem. So that was recognized. Council said, okay, that's not what we were wanting to do. So let's put an interim regulation in place and kick it back to the Planning Commission to consider. So what you have in your packet is that interim regulation. And do you guys mind if I just walk you through some of the sections? Because you'll see it might help you, because we're not going to review or deliberate tonight on this, but it will help you think it through as you do go home and kind of review the packet.
I do have some questions as we go through.
Okay, perfect.
The
main first section, and Mike, you're going to pop in whenever because there's a lot in here, but the first section where we just talk about the purpose, we created, before the CLDR was such a minor part of it, we just really had the word CLDR and talked about that similar to LDR. So we did not do that in this provision. We created an actual call out to what it is. Okay. Then when you go to the planned neighborhood district on page 3, what that is that's a section of the code that allowed cottage housing in the LDR zone. So we were going to, the previous regulation was to continue to allow that. But when the council went to a large, large lot, which is 18,000 square foot lot, it doesn't really make any more necessarily sense to allow that cottage, because now you're talking about real big differences. At least that was their mentality. So basically, that section just says, hey, you can't really build a cottage development in this zone. Okay?
In CLDR.
Yeah.
But, Jenna, given the current council's thinking, do they want to still continue to allow a small section of LDR as cottage homes? I understand constrained residential, but
yeah.
I'm asking the question, if we're going to touch the code, should we also find out about having cottage in LDR
instead of
just the cottage zone? And mm-hmm. I know, you know, providing flexibility and you know, site-specific, you know, accommodations is great, but given their current feel, maybe we ought to consider that as a...
Are you saying considering not allowing cottage?
In LDR.
That's something you guys can talk about. I do know that they informally had a mini retreat, and there was some discussion about whether attached housing in the LDR zone through a PMD should still be allowed. They knew that cottage was allowed, and they did not express an interest to not allow cottage in the LDR through this PND, because it does say that it's only 15%.
And you're still limited to your underlying density. You still can't go over 4 units per acre.
Your cottage provides the inventory of affordable housing.
Potentially, yeah. But it also allows, Gary, I really think the more you can mix housing types, the more you break up the monotony of the production builder. And that vibe of cookie cutterness.
I appreciate it. I partly said that, and I thank you for talking about the council's retreat. I wanted to let the planning commission staff know I sent the mayor an email asking him if both the city council and planning commission can get together in an offsite. So once they've kind of formalized what their vision is and they've gotten more cohesive, to have a chance for us to digest that same understanding and for us to just kind of mingle and be able to ask them questions about their thinking. So I'm waiting to hear back on that.
Okay, so moving on to the tables. The first table you'll see is what we call our 18-10-030. It's our permitted use chart, and I'm gonna give more detail than normal, just as because we have a new one. A new person.
I appreciate that.
So this chart basically is as simple as if it's got a P in the chart, that means it's permitted. And if it does not, it means it's not permitted. If it has something else, like a planned neighborhood development, you would have to go to that section of the code to understand that. So what we did in this chart is you can see before we treated LDR and CLDR the same in the realm of what was permitted and what's not. What we've done now is create its own column. Mm-hmm. And the CLDR is pretty limited to single-family residential, and we are required to have manufacturing home allowed as a state requirement, so that's allowed. And then basically that chart continues on to have some minor P's in the chart.
Hey, Jenna, mm-hmm. Could I go back to page 2 and just ask, on LDR, mm-hmm. There's a section on multifamily and co-housing. Is that what you were referring to that was being discussed?
I know
that was raised at one of our meetings.
That's
a question.
Are you talking about the 124 and 126?
124.
Yeah. So that might be coming to you, or we may we might be able to open that up and deal with it at this point in the realm of P&D. I don't want to speak for the council, but I believe what I heard was cottage is okay in the LDR, but we're not really sure multifamily is appropriate. And this would be a place where we could take that P and remove the P.
Okay.
Okay.
That term co-housing, what is that?
Families living in a house that maybe was divided for two families. That's how I understood it.
Let me read that.
I think it typically got like a singular kitchen and then independent living spaces that share that kitchen. Kitchen or shared living room.
It's like an Oxford house.
Kind of, yeah. Which, that's actually more like a, just like co-housing was kind of popular in the 70s, I think, and it's since almost, it's
merged
almost like having a, yeah, it's communal.
I just think, you know, if the Planning Commission wants to talk about it now, my personal thought was, if I'm thinking LDR is, you know, family and residential, it's not single and as much it is more family environment, and so does that fit with our LDR zone? I was feeling like it didn't, and it kind of stood out to me as something that didn't make sense. So it helps, I think, my years on the Planning Commission of really gelling with understanding the code now. So.
Yeah.
Taking that one.
So that's something that, you know, chalk up as a discussion item. Okay, so then... I'll keep on the same track. Right now, if we have a section open, and there's something that we know we can accomplish that the council has an interest in, I do believe we can wrap it into this process, and I think that would be a valuable use of time since we have this section open. Even though, from a legal standpoint, we are dealing with the CLDR requirement for you guys to come back and deal with it. But I do not believe that doesn't restrict us from expanding our purview a little bit.
Your wish is that we don't take 2 months in doing so.
No, my wish is if the council has some things that they want to accomplish like that, let's get it done and try to wrap it into one effort than you guys having to restart on the same chart in a month.
So, Jenna, on page 4,
mm-hmm.
Under CLDR, under section 1.50, other residential.
Mm-hmm.
Accessory residential uses and accessory dwelling residential is mm-hmm. permitted. I'm just wondering, you know, how rural it should be and how much lot coverage it should be, especially, you know, maybe it just needs to be an exception if you are in a floodplain or some flood restriction that it's not permitted or that your maximum lot coverage could be X. And I don't know what the answer is, but mm-hmm. I think there should be some accommodation, at least for wetlands or floodplains or something. For lot coverage.
Yeah, so the next chart, when we get to 040, the lot coverage is there. But accessory, these almost really shouldn't be called out as uses because these are kind of accessory to the primary use when the primary use is single family. An accessory residential use is like a barn or
a
shop. Somebody wants to do those. So it really is something that's maybe a little... And then an accessory dwelling unit, that's allowed in any zone, subject to our accessory dwelling unit standards. So those all make sense for people to really, you know, whether they want their mother who needs some help to move home and live in the apartment above the garage, or, you know, those are all good flexibilities that are nice to have.
Apartment above the garage.
Shop.
There you go. So and that's a great use of your property, and it fits with the character. So then home occupations, that's normal. Child care, that kind of stuff is normal to have those in-house type of activities.
Mm-hmm.
Bed and breakfast, same thing. If we're moving in onto page 5, of course we have electric charging stations.
Yeah,
are a no-brainer.
Could you tell me, is that like a charging station for a public use, or
no,
is that just in your home?
Accessory to a principal use, so that's for your private use, or whatever the particular use
is. Do we
is,
not allow that in general anywhere? So if anybody in LDR or CLDR
it's
has
everywhere.
An electric vehicle?
It's everywhere. We allow it. The P's go across the
yeah.
chart, and it says accessory to the principal use. So Mike actually did a great job working through a lot of the those regulations a couple years ago. So
that was to differentiate from charging station as a public use. We didn't necessarily want to see those in residential neighborhoods. So.
So then moving onward, you actually don't, you know, nothing else, no commercial, nothing is allowed, of course, this is not that zone. When you get to, so the chart becomes pretty much a bunch of blank boxes until you get to page 10, which talks about, like, under public and quasi-public athletic fields or sports facilities. That is a park. It's something that you'll, under that title, is public and quasi-public. So quasi-public would be maybe side view. This is just giving the flexibility that, if appropriate in any zone, the city or the city's partners could build a park, and that might include some sports facilities. So. And then that's on page 16 of that chart. Okay, and then moving on, we are allowing schools. It's not necessarily something that I think is a viable. You know, it would be unusual to have a school. I think maybe potentially seek out any of those particular parcels. But you know, schools are allowed in all.
This is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
These resource uses on. This is excellent. Good going, you guys.
So
yeah,
Jenna,
yeah.
You're on page 17?
I'm on 18.
He's on 18.
Okay. On page 17, we have churches and religious institutions,
mm-hmm.
and then museums and interpretive, mass transit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see cemetery anywhere in this.
It should be. It's, let me look on the card real quick. I know we have it.
Did I miss it?
Mm-hmm.
fascinating show on it. In England, there's actually no restriction that you could bury yourself in your own land, in your in the city. There's no restriction in the code for that. But it makes selling your house hard.
Yeah,
it is funny. If you don't mind, it's not in the chart from based on my cook for sure. But let me think about that, because I actually think...
My request is, you know, we should add in a line whether permitted or not is discussion point, but I think...
It should be,
we have a duty, I think, to our population to either provide for them.
What we have is still in there.
And it's not really owned and managed. That's what Elizabeth's been working on.
Right.
So, I think if somebody found a sizable lot...
In a floodplain, that could, that has the possibility to make the coffins rise because they're sealed, and then you have that whole health
hazard. The way addresses that.
How do they do it?
Above ground. I'm not saying where it should be permitted. I think we need a line in land uses somewhere in that area.
That might be, and let me ponder that, because we do have, that's almost expanding out of the commercial, or the...
residential.
Because we do have some time frames on this, so if we get into that, that might be on our list of next priority.
Wouldn't that come under the category of parks?
It is in parks and open space. But
well, it could be private.
It should be private.
I'd love to have a conversation because I have lots of thoughts on cemeteries. But not
fascinating. I'm intrigued.
Land vertically.
Well, there's that's.
So we will figure out the best way to address that, because, yeah, you're right. At some point, we need to get that going.
My request is if it doesn't go on the table now, then it goes on our schedule.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, so Dick already pointed out the resource section that we have. So that's your permitted use chart for the CLDR zone. quite frankly, I feel like that chart's pretty basic. There's not much there to... really dive into because it is the large lot zone, so it's clearly going to be the basic residential zone where we aren't getting real complex with what's permitted, what's not. Before we move,
back on page 12 under land uses, commercial truck travel centers. I know council is going to hold the meeting on April 5th, but it says see North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.025. I don't know if that is the correct thing we need to have there or not. I'm just asking you to keep watch of that if it needs to be changed. I don't know what it should change to, either permitted, not permitted, or what. But since that's an open topic.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I'm looking at page 12, land uses 2.33.
Okay.
Commercial truck travel centers, where it refers to the North Bend Municipal Code, which we just had a meeting on.
That's a good point.
So just for you guys to watch it, as long as we're moving this through, make that housekeeping.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
No, that's a good point, because how that reads. Because it will change it. Okay, next chart is your 18.10.040, and these are what we call bulk and dimensional standards. So this basically is pretty essential section of our code that gives you the details on how the lot, how big the lot should be, how wide the lot should be, where the home can sit on the lot based on our setbacks. And those things.
Jenna, on page 21, under LDR, we have an average lot size of 8,000 square feet and a minimum of 7,500 square feet.
Right.
Why wouldn't it be just 8,000 square feet? I don't know. Is that a change that happened, like when council passed it, or why is it less, I guess? than the 8,000 square feet?
We have historically had an average bare minimum and then also an average minimum. And that's just to address, there's a lot of site circumstances where it's going to be difficult to provide that minimum throughout. So.
And part of it is a couple of years ago, like 5 or 6, the minimum lot size was 5,000. And that then the council, you guys raised it to
8,000.
Yeah,
went to 6,500.
Went to 6,500. Anyway, I think what this allows is exactly what Mike says. It gives you the flexibility to not only meet your, we want to have diversity in size of lots. So this gives developers that ability to not just separate. Because when you have a prescribed 8,000 or 9,000 or whatever number you pick,
that's what you're going to have consistently.
You get a cookie cutter. You get more cookie cutters. So it's a challenge because what you want to do is you want to regulate to your lowest common denominator. So you bring those people up to the level of what you want to see your design to be. But you also don't want to be so prescriptive. Now you're forcing monotony. So anyway, back to the CLDR chart. If you go through minimum lot size, the council chose 18,000 square foot for the minimum lot size. That, I'm going to just spend a few seconds on that. That is about as big as you can get and still, potentially still, meet all the other requirements that go into building. So, for example, your street standards. We have a 54-foot right-of-way. So when you start thinking about your 54-foot right-of-way and your stormwater requirements, the typical number you try to average is about 17% of the development is public infrastructure. So your 17 to 25. I usually use 20 as kind of the 20 to 22 to be kind of safe. When you do the math here, that leaves 20% of an acre is 8,730 square feet for roads and stormwater. That's not very much, so just kind of keep that in mind as you're pondering this. It would be probably difficult without really diving into the street standards to go a lot bigger.
I don't want to make your streets any narrower. Right.
I mean, if you, yeah. I mean, that's your call.
Yeah. Sorry. That was a personal one.
Did
we talked about
streets about a year ago.
You did.
We did it to 9 foot.
Yeah. So anyway, moving on. So they chose 8,000 square feet. 18. Mm-hmm. Then
and
moving.
We took out the, sorry.
No, I have a cold.
We took out the average lot size in USOD, which is just going to be based now on the underlying zone. So it was LDR, it's LDR.
Yeah. And, or, for example, they actually rezoned the CLDR out in the USOD. The LDR now is CLDR, so the underlying zone would be the 18,000 square foot lot size. So 22 is not applicable. Page 22. Page 23 is you start getting to maximum lot size. Well, we've taken that out. And then, so it doesn't apply to CLDR, and then max size continued. Then on 24, you have the minimum lot width. They went with 90. So the minimum lot width would be 90. So that, are you interested in the math?
No. What my take is that they want the perception of wider spaced apart, and they're not concerned
exactly
about depth of lot.
Right. They up on the street, they want it to look more rural in nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's achieves that.
So
and 1 square acre, like if it was perfectly square,
uh-huh.
would be how far across?
Oh.
Because you're not going for an acre, so you'll be almost as wide as you would on an acre lot, but you're not as deep.
Gotcha. All right.
That was my perception of that.
Well, 90 by 200,
an acre,
90 feet wide by 200 feet deep is 1,800 square feet, 18,000 square feet.
You're
right?
Say that again.
If you go 90 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
so if you do this 90 foot lot.
90 by 90.
If this is 90, and you need 18,000 square foot lot, if you go with the minimum, you're now 200 feet. Yeah, right? That equals?
18,000,
yeah. Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to be very deep.
Not as deep as an acre as what else?
Oh, sorry, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I thought you meant as
visualizations.
Okay, so moving to page.
And you're talking about visualization, and Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Wood River is kind of the overall context of what this would look like.
Possibly. Their lots are actually quite wider than 90. They have almost 100 something, 120. They're half acre.
They're three quarter,
yeah. I looked at some of the widths, and they were in the 120 here. So it's more than, yeah. Okay, so moving to 25, you got your front yard setback. They actually put that at 30 feet. Then moving to 20. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. So my only thought, if you have wetlands, you have slopes, you're measuring from property line to that point, is that correct? So regardless of...
Yeah, so your well, when they lay out a...
So your front part is the wetland, and so your... Is that minimum setback?
Yeah, that's minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We have a variance process that would help to address site circumstances where you really can't provide the house at a certain depth.
Or that's the lower elevation of it, and so it would make sense to put it
mm-hmm.
further back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's typical.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
You could put it closer in that circumstance. Mm-hmm.
And actually, wetlands per our code are actually required to be placed in a track, so you wouldn't have one on a lot. It would be required to be put into a track. That is that part of that 17 to 25% of you know, infrastructural or other uses than lots that you want to calculate into your development. So again, moving on to page 26, which doesn't apply to the GLDR. Page 27, again, we're still on maximum front yard. We don't have a maximum. Doesn't apply. 28, we're talking now side yard setback. These are minimums, so they put minimum is 10 on one side, 20 total. So it's 10 feet on both sides, the minimum. Moving on to 29. Rear yard setback is 25 feet. Page 30 shows the height. This is the same typical 35 feet that we have for all other single family residents. 31, that's where we get into the maximum building coverage, and we basically, they kept that at the same as the LDR, and of course that is 35% of that larger lot that would actually yield a pretty decent length.
How long has our height been 35 feet? Is that?
Since, that's a pretty standard height for single family residential. It allows some, yeah, it allows some real nice pitches. We do have a provision that on narrow lots, you have to have a short, you have to stay at 29 just because you're going to have a tower. So 32, page 32 doesn't apply. Let's see here, or maybe it did. It does. Okay, so if you look at the maximum impervious surface on 32, you have to flip it over. It's 55%. So it's a little less than what we allow for the LDR.
Hold on. 55% of 18%.
Of 1,800? You said 55%.
Yeah, of 18,000 minimum lot size.
9,900.
That's quite a house.
But no, that's impervious surface. That's your driveways. That's everything. That's four courts.
Well, if I build a gravel driveway, it's still
that would be considered impervious.
Slab concrete that's sectioned with drain field.
Drain field like a septic system?
No,
oh.
That has a, you know, gravel underneath, and then you have slabs of concrete that are in sections to drive on.
If you got clever and you actually built an impervious driveway, yes, you could still build. It would be, this is impervious. You could get clever and build a pervious driveway.
Reduce amount of concrete and sort of water.
Just. Is 55% the right amount?
So there'll be a few people who can beat the system. Okay. No. Even that Christopher.
Well, if you have a 30-foot driveway, that's 10 feet wide. That's 300 square feet. So take off 300 square feet, you still get quite a huge house.
Well, I could run some of the math that we did, but driveways are typically...
Well, they'll be a little bit wider in front of the garage.
They're typically 20 feet wide because they line up with the garage. And these homes will probably have three-car garages, so you'll probably actually have a 30-foot driveway that tapers to a 16-foot apron. So
1,000 foot.
So you have...
1,000 square feet.
Assuming this isn't, that they set that to the minimum front yard setback.
Well, just to understand, too, are you suggesting that that's too high of a
mm-hmm. level?
Well, I'm going to the point of when we're talking about affordability, this is in the opposite direction of, and that's fine to have diversity in our housing stock. That's quite a lot of building on one lot. And
well, there's also outbuilding, so if somebody wanted to do a garage or a barn in their backyard, that's
but
still
important. I'm getting this. That tone. When I'm listening to the council on TV, I'm hearing that tone. They want to have bigger homes on bigger lots. We're not getting that kind of inventory right now. That's the feeling I'm getting they're looking for.
Well, I think when you, going back to your question on affordability, an 18,000 square foot lot in King County is not the area that is going to yield the affordable home.
Oh, I'm not looking for that, but I'm thinking about, I don't know anybody that's building an 8,000 square foot home. I'd have to look in the uplands to see, if they're all 4,000, 5,000 square feet or 6,000 square feet. But, people might build towards our code. Is that in our best interest to have so much impervious surface is what I'm asking the commission to talk about. It's... I don't know what the future holds, but is this something we're going to end up promoting? Is the new 8,000 square foot home?
Well, wait. And remember, go back to your building coverage. So your building coverage for this zone is 18,000 square feet times 0.35 for without an ADU. So you could have 35% of that lot is 6,300. So you could actually do a two-story, 12,000 square foot, almost 13,000 square foot. Oh, yeah. It's like a mansion. But
yeah.
Realistically, that's not.
So the condo, is that saying?
Right. You're not, yeah, you're going to pick something.
So if you did a Rambler and you did a sports court and a detached, you know, the barn in the backyard, you're going to be up against that limit.
Yeah, the building coverage would be the barn and the home, the sport court, and the driveway. Things to think about. Like I said, this is the intro night, so you're bringing up good questions or good thoughts.
I would love to live there.
Okay,
we're looking for a recreational committee for the Isle of Wight.
With that, you don't need trails or park requirements.
That was it then. So that chart, then the only thing is footnotes that just clarify. The footnotes just basically support the chart. So lastly, the last part of this was your performance standards. And this is where we made the least amount of changes. And you'll see it's actually the only change might be on page 39. Where we had to, where because we don't allow LDR or PND in the CLDR, we just deleted that. And I think that was the only edit in that whole chart.
Jenna, before you move on.
Yeah.
In page 39, we talk about landscaping requirements that residential, in the residential section. Do we have landscaping requirements for our city-owned properties?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we would, anytime the city develops something, we apply the same regulations to our development.
I guess I'm speaking specifically to the Tetra Tech?
Oh, the wastewater treatment plant.
Wastewater treatment plant proposal, the treescape that they proposed didn't exactly look like it was to our code. So
no,
that's why I was asking.
That hadn't been through the planning department yet.
So for the Planning Commission, the last city council meeting, they talked about the sewer plant and the improvements. And they showed treescape in front to beautify it, which I recognize is not compliant with our code.
No. Sorry. I noted that.
You guys got that.
What was being offered? What was the issue?
I think maybe after the meeting or in good of the order we can talk about that. It's not it's basically what to do to accommodate growth, I guess, is the easiest way I can answer that, and how much it will cost based on each option.
You're thinking just the tree, though, right? So
oh.
Just the tree part of it, Dick, was they were just showing that by putting a row of Leland cypress up, you could screen the wastewater treatment plant very easily, but Gary knows that our landscape code includes a mix of trees and shrubs and this and that to get a full screen. And so that would be something we definitely have to work through in the plan.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm misunderstood. All right, moving on.
So that basically, like I said, the rest of this chart, I included it all just because that's what you would do, even though there are no other edits. So we have, that is the introduction of the CLDR zone. Like I said, I think if you guys have some thoughts or anything, otherwise we'll come back and deliberate on it next meeting.
I've given some of mine, and we'll continue on. Performance standards are not something that I've spent a lot of time with, but it seems to be where a lot of the meaty requirements and good information. Anything else? Okay. So, the next thing on our agenda is the schedule for 2016, and I'd like to thank you very much for putting this together. It's something I've been wanting to do. And I guess for me, On May 12, 2016, we talked about street standards and amendments in conjunction with development of public work standards.
You know, I have to say, I believe that the street standards, we're going to have to move that. You know, this came out before I had the retreat. And based on that, I do think we're going to put together kind of a schedule now to help the council accomplish what they. And so I think that might be pushed back, because that actually might be one of your more meaty topics. So it might need a little more time to prepare.
I just have a question about it. Is that where we'll talk about sidewalk standards?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so my understanding then is this is a draft of a schedule that will change.
This is right now, these are all the things we know we have on the plate, and we know more are going to get added soon. So
these are always subject to change.
Yeah.
Also, something that we heard about a while ago last year was signs and our sign requirements, which are kind of outdated.
I'll tell you, you know, here's my thought on our sign code. You guys had 24 meetings, and we have a council right now that's going to, I think, be bringing a lot of new tasks your way. The sign code is a very big code to amend. It would probably, I would think, be at least 5 to 6 meetings at a minimum.
Well, there's also the issue of the Supreme Court recently provided a determination about content neutrality that a lot of cities are going to have to resolve in their sign codes. And rather than trying to be the first one out there that resolves that in this area, it might be better for us to sit back a little bit and see how somebody else addresses it so that we can
let a bigger city
digest
it.
Is this a U.S.
But what we do, what I would like to do, though, is because this, I wouldn't mind actually putting a request in next year to maybe get some consulting services to help us put together.
Because I was thinking a 50s neon theme throughout downtown might
hey,
be, you
actually,
know, good marketing.
That's allowed.
Sorry.
But stay tuned, because that might be something that gets requested for a work plan, a funded work plan next year that we can hire somebody, because we are pretty much maxed out in this office. So.
Another topic we've discussed was the exit 34 gateway design or something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, we're bringing, I need to bring council's priorities to you guys, and the gateway is was something that was more of a planning commission priority. I do think that we can still accomplish it, maybe not as early in the year as we would like, but what I would like to do, because I think gateway design, it's really helpful to have the professional consulting services there to back us and support the drawings and drafting, because it will be a very visual discussion. So we're going to go out and issue an RFP to get a consulting team on board to help us design exit 34, that corridor. Mountain Sound Greenway is really interested in kind of taking charge on and helping potentially find more partners to make it a bigger success. But we do have $48,000 to do that work in. So. Mike started the draft, and I haven't gotten to it, but we're hoping to issue the RFP probably in late May and have it designed by the end of the year. With that process, though, what we'll have is we'll have a professional consulting team that can really bring some strategic ideas on how to create a gateway for them, because the reason why it's obviously getting the attention of Mountain Sound Greenway is it's the gateway to the Middle Fork. So I really think that process is we're going to get a stellar gateway design. And then the goal would be then to take that design and start implementing the features that we want to mimic throughout all our gateways. So I'm kind of hoping to use this process and these funds to initiate the gateway process, and then maybe next year you guys expand it.
Okay.
So that's kind of the goal, and maybe even with some funding requests to dial in each city gateway or what have you. But that's something we can talk about later.
Would we be at all at risk of losing those funds that have been provisioned, I guess, is my only concern if we didn't do it by a certain time.
Oh, we're going to do that this year. We're going to issue the RFP to get the team together. So that will probably be a 6-week. We'll give people 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks to provide their proposals. So I would say by July, we'll have the team together that will be working on that design.
Okay.
The goal will be to have that all done by the end of the year, which will then start your process.
Then my one other thought was when we did the transportation element of the comprehensive plan, it was back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Through that process, we did a prioritization of street improvement projects, which, of course, is dependent on
traffic impact.
No, that, but also grants and, uh-huh. and different things, funds available to get for different initiatives, right? Does that at all come back? Does that improvement list at all come back to us? Or is it just going to be part of the transportation element and we review it when we review that?
That's the case, yeah.
Okay.
So the Public Works Department annually updates that TIP based on funding and prioritization, but it's based out of checking things off from the transportation element larger list.
Now, lastly, I can give you a little quick update on the comp plan. PSRC reviews and certifies your comp plan. The last time they recertified a element was in 2012 with the transportation. So what they're doing for all small cities, small and rural, they're issuing what they call a conditional certification. So what that means is they're asking all of us small cities who've been growing quite quickly to go back and kind of evaluate a 20-year estimate versus capacity. We don't think that's going to require an amendment to the code or anything, but it will require the city to kind of back up some of our, or provide that additional information is what it is.
Is that more like your GIS guy who did the estimates? Or?
Yeah, but you know, providing a 20-year estimate is it really is like throwing a dart at the wall because, you know, in 2006 when everything was booming, who would have thought by the end of 2008 we would have had that many foreclosures and, you know, life was on, like, Snoqualmie Ridge, 15 or 20% of was for being foreclosed. I mean, that was huge.
State.
Yeah.
So you've got a sewer district plant to worry about. You know, that's going to be a big driver before you throw that dart.
Yeah, so we're going to think that through. We're going to kind of learn what PSRC is wanting. They did express that you guys what we call our employment target is really low because we're considered a small city. But we're on 990 corridor, and we're one of the last areas that has vacant land. So our capacity is high. So they expressed a concern that we have too much capacity for being a small city. And I'm not really sure if the concern is that people will drive from Issaquah out here to go to work. But clearly, that's actually a good problem to have. And, you know, a couple things that we've done really well in this city is we have not, the reason we have that capacity is we haven't decided to allow other less job-producing uses to absorb it, like warehouse or whatever use, you know, you could say doesn't yield. Bonnie Lake, for example, has allowed a lot of their employment areas to be kind of developed by big box retail, which doesn't provide that living wage job. So we've said, basically, we want to see living wage jobs in our employment districts. And it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. But that's the one thing we'll be looking at. That was their main area of interest with North Bend is basically how do you have so much capacity? And so, you know, we'll work that through. I mean, there are...
Capacity as a percentage of the city isn't large. So I guess...
No, it's capacity they're looking at based on their target. Lands. They gave us a target for employment of, what, 1,000?
Oh, that's really low.
And we have a capacity of, like, 7,000. So they're like, whoa. But, you know.
Are they going to advocate for us?
They're probably not right now advocating their own that, you know, I think they're wanting to understand how we can bring those numbers back closer. But, for example, like we just told them, you know, rezoning to allow warehouses is not in the best interest of providing a place where you can live and work.
Well, I mean advocating for businesses to locate here.
Oh, that would be nice.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's the, I'll keep you posted on that as we move through the process on what that looks like and if anything's coming your way in 2000. It wouldn't be till next year, though.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. And that's it from my end.
All right. Well, how about good of the order or administrative items? Ms. Miller, you handed out some maps. Would you like to talk about that?
Well, just take a few moments here. Earlier this week, I went down to Public Works and just wanted to get myself more information first and foremost. And once I started that launching pad, I wanted to bring all of us on board together so it's not up. It's not me doing it on my own kind of thing. So I think this is information that's going to keep us updated. I know the TIP projects is going to be updated again in June. So around that month, I'll probably go back and collect what's happening at that point. This kind of visual information is, I think it's a good thing to have in general. So that's my thought.
Mike, is this something similar to what you guys have up on the wall that I've...
Yeah, we have it. It's probably the same map. It's just the color.
That's the one Carrie put together. Okay. We do have...
Yours has more handwritten.
Yeah. No, ours is actually, we have a final, most up-to-date, I don't know if that helps, but this is quite up-to-date too, but ours shows also the public improvement streets, so...
So it's more in-depth then?
Maybe. I haven't really looked at this one, but...
Okay.
It's a map that changes, so we don't usually distribute it. I mean, we can. It's just it will have a date, and it will say something like "subject to change tomorrow" because we get new projects.
Well, I imagine that to be the case too. But I thought something rather than nothing is a good way to start. So, simply put. Thanks for being interested in that.
Sure. Ask staff a question. I've been watching the Picket Connection route my back, and I understand there's a small piece of property that is yet to be acquired. So I'm just wondering what the plan is with that or projection.
It's on the city's 6-year transportation improvement plan, so it is slated to happen. There's no funding or plan at the moment to acquire it.
Gotcha. So right now that road's just going to go until the end of the water main?
Yeah, to the property line.
Is that a 5-acre parcel, excuse me?
No, this is the Pulte construction.
Okay.
Out by the Ranger Station, behind E.J. Roberts.
Right.
Yeah, sure. So in the meantime, is that going to be paved? Is it going to be gated? Is it going to...
It will be paved with a barricade at the end of it.
At the end? Is there any possibility of discussing relocating that barricade so that we don't have people parking with an easy exit from our neighborhood, like moving the barricade further towards the other end, since it won't be accessing any houses?
What do you mean by...
So
I understand where you want it, but are you concerned that people are going to park on it?
Yes, and then access our neighborhood, possibly for... unwanted reasons.
But well, it wouldn't prevent pedestrian access.
No, but it would provide a much longer walk as opposed to having a car on one side.
I guess what I mean is that the type of barricade is not a fence, it's just a couple of posts with some crossbars.
Not looking to keep people out, looking to keep cars further away so that they're just not walking through. I mean, to be honest, the extreme that I'm thinking is somebody sets up...
Why not get a no parking sign?
They don't walk at 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody's going to be breaking their house. Because they're not paying attention to locked doors.
Yeah, I understand your point, though. You don't want to have drug deals or whatever going on in
right.
the street.
At the end of roads, we already have one at Blue Hole, attracts a wide variety of users. You know, we would have two in our area, as opposed to just putting up barriers since there's no other side access off of it, just further up the drainage, you know, closer to where the main use is going to be.
I can bring that comment forward in Public Works.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that's all. And you can also look at that on our site.
Pardon?
I wonder what the police department has lost sight of that, or has.
I don't think it's on the radar yet.
No, I mean, it's been discussed because we thought through the plotting process that was discussed. You know, actually, the developer was wanting to not build the road, so that was one of their arguments. And in the end, who would get caught holding the bag would be the citizens to provide that connection. The one thing I'm wondering is, you know, the barricade's always going to go at the end of the road, because we don't want the opposite. You're cutting across that one piece of property that's somebody's driveway and then hitting that road and then coming to the barricade. And, you know what I mean? So without...
No, actually, no, I don't.
So, if you have...
Because the road actually does currently go all the way to the property line.
Here's
Pickett. Both ends.
And then here's this house, and here's the other end of Pickett, and this is the new development, right?
Okay.
Barricade's going to go right here.
Yeah.
Okay? You're asking for it to go here, so when people, they can't go any farther past. If anything, it has to be in both locations, because if we take it here, people then will be trying to come and potentially cut.
Gotcha.
So my point is first of all, we could do two things. You know, you can wait and see if this actually becomes a problem, because it might not.
Yeah.
Or we have to put in two barricades, is my thinking. But we can talk about it with the engineering plan. I think it's almost a problem. Wait and see if it's a problem, then we put up a second barricade if it does.
In our neighborhood, we put up a neighborhood watch sign as you pulled into it, and it's dramatically cut down the traffic.
Good tip. Thanks.
Okay. There was a special council work study that happened this past week. And Jenna, I don't know if you're prepared today, but is there anything that you could relay to the Planning Commission about that event?
You're talking about the mini retreat?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably not ready to get into the details because I have yet to staff, like, you know, where I really want to walk through it all with my staff and then decide, kind of give the council some best forward movement options. But the area that they discussed, like I said, was related to, it was all oriented on the yellow LDR zoning, and the common threads of conversation, I think, that the council was pretty in sync with was definitely on that peripheral parts of our town, having, you know, keeping that rural small town character via larger lots, buried setbacks. You know, there's definitely that feeling of when you do go into some of these new neighborhoods, everything's set the same line, even if it's only, even if it's set 5 feet apart, you can't, it's undistinguishable. So really trying to get some more variation in setbacks, lot sizes, so mix in some big lots into, you know, maybe some of the, like the 8,000 range. So a lot more variety. There's definitely an interest to have the larger lot. And then, of course, with that will come conversations regarding access and roads and neighbors' character, which your public street is, what, almost 15% of any land use, so that's a pretty big defining character feature. So that will come into play, too, in the conversation. So,
was there... on the schedule, they had a zoning map exercise. They perceiving anything drastic as far as changes go, or it was just more of learning what the zones are and where they are?
Yeah, I mean, basically the format was more about drawing out their common vision from a neighborhood standpoint. So the zoning map exercise, actually it was, I'm trying to think if they even got to that. The big discussion actually when it came to zoning was articulated that we need to really break up the LDR. But what I think that will ultimately mean is creating more required variation of lot sizes. And like right now, the minimum lot size in LDR is 8,000 with the average of, minimum is 75 with the average of 8. And then you go to that variation section of our code that says every fourth lot has to vary by 500 square feet and 5 feet width or something, 10 feet width. I see that those becoming much bigger potentially, so, you know, just based on the creating that variation. As you know, we cannot amend the comp plan more than
once a year. But we can talk about it.
You can talk about it, and you can get ready to do it, and you can definitely update your bulk of dimensional, which is the key instrument in getting the look and feel built that you're going for.
Okay. I have a really old note, and I'm sorry to do this to the Planning Commission and to the staff, but we discussed a docket on indoor commercial recreation facilities. Whatever happened to that? And I don't recall if the applicant didn't pursue it anymore, or, you know, lost track of the idea.
On that particular person did.
And that's okay. I
think that it went through. It's shown now in the urban separator overlay district. I don't know what that was before.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I think that the Planning Commission did take action on that.
Yeah, you're right.
I didn't staff that, so I'm not totally familiar. But
I remember we approved that. But or you're asking like what happened to the
firearms, but not shooting ranges, but it was something to do with indoor commercial recreation.
Yeah, 2.23A, indoor shooting range.
Yeah, you're right, it went through. We addressed it.
But, yeah, I thought it was something
that was in at one point.
Yeah, it was a docket request.
And it was addressed, and then actually the place she was looking at.
Anything else?
Yeah.
Well, I have a tidbit. I was there asking Mike about it. I confirmed with the owner. The owner has sold the old cedar mill to the Skagit tribe.
Where's the old cedar mill?
It's the storage unit right there on the North Bendway. She doesn't know what's going to happen to it. That's been in the family for 70 years. Her father's father owned it, built it, all that, but he sold it. I heard the price was around $5 million for
the Skagit or Snoqualmie?
Skagit.
So, is it a tribe's able to buy land and convert it into?
I don't know.
Their own territory, right?
They have the ability to do. I just know that they have assets like every tribe does these days, and they have ways to use them. Now, they might see something at that site for far different reasons. You know, they might see it as a community. Retail center, who knows?
Well, they have to meet our zoning. It's not sovereign land.
But if they convert it into,
that's a pretty complicated process.
They actually, unless
the tribe did it,
they were recognized and as a result had the ability to create a reservation, and to expand your reservation, it needs to be contiguous land. There has been efforts to change that, and as of my knowledge right now, although I haven't researched this in a year or two, maybe even longer, it still has to be contiguous to the reservation. So you can keep your reservation can get bigger; it just can't become spotty.
Okay.
But their idea is, you know, they have the potential of turning our land use plan upside down in that area if we don't get ahead of it.
Well, anything that they would submit would still have to comply to the city's regulations.
So if they wanted to do a hotel, for example, or something?
Yeah, they would not be able to do a hotel there, for example, because it's employment park.
Right. Which is managed as a rental storage. That's what it is now, right?
Yeah, I mean, they could just be investing just like anybody.
But I don't think so. We're skeptical of that.
Well, the thing is, right, at this point, they'd have to meet our code provisions. So.
It's a really interesting.
It is. Yeah.
Anything else? I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I really enjoyed tonight's meeting, by the way. You guys really came prepared. Your stuff here is great. It's a great change.
We always
come prepared.
We always come prepared. It's like, how many topics do you juggle in your head?
I have a motion. Can I get a second?
Second.
All right. We have a motion to adjourn by Mr. Bontrup, second by Ms. Miller. All those in favor of adjourning?
Aye. Aye.
We are adjourned at 9:05.
I like how you've gone back to pause between all those in favor. Yeah. The one time you did
I ran too fast.